Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, and welcome to Nature Now for this second week of June. Whoa, has it been a hot one lately? But it is cooling down a bit nicely. I'm your host, Nan Evans. And today, we will revisit an interview I did in September 2015 with Emily Grayson of the University of Washington and Jeff Adams of Washington Sea Grant. We'll be talking about the invasive green crab. But first, let's hear this week's mystery sound. Here's a bit of a hint. I heard this sound on a whale-watching trip to the San Juan Islands this past weekend. We'll come back to the mystery sound a little bit later in the program, but first, I want to share some of the natural history observations from a wonderful low-tide field trip that I made with my friends Wendy Feltham and Lee Merrill. We left Port Townsend Sunday morning about 6:30 or so to drive out to Salt Creek County Park west of Port Angeles for one of the lowest tides of this spring and summer. Salt Creek is a fascinating location to explore intertidal habitats. It has many of the species of the wild open ocean coast, along with those species more suited to the calmer waters of the Salish Sea. Poking in and around and under the rocks and tide pools, we fascinated ourselves for hours, just seeing what we could find. Some of the highlights included scores of beautiful purple and bright red sea urchins, especially at the lower tide levels. Dozens of blood stars and six-legged brooding stars, plus one striped sun star and one mottled star. Sadly, we did not see any pisaster, those are the ochre stars, or the sunflower stars that were so badly affected by the sea star wasting disease. We saw lots of sea anemones, of course, including huge, bright green surf anemones hugging the sides of surf channels and rocky tide pools. Rose anemones, vast cloned colonies of the pink-tipped aggregating anemones, the proliferating anemone that fertilizes embryos inside its fleshy body. The embryos then emerge and attach themselves to the adult's column or trunk and grow there until eventually elbowed off by growing siblings. We saw a large sea lemon nudibranch, or sometimes called a sea slug, was about 10 inches long with its recently laid ribbonry coiled egg mass. In the fish world, in nearly every tide pool and under exposed seaweed-covered rocks, lots of the cute tide pool sculpins, scores of the funny little clingfishes with their broad heads and the sucking disc on the underside. That's a weird modification of the pelvic fins, which allow this little fish to tenaciously secure its hold on its home. We saw a couple of slithery gunnels that moved so quickly to hide among the pebbles that we could never actually positively identify which kind of gunnel. And lastly, in the topic of weird or odd and wonderful sightings, small what we think were orange cup corals. They differ from their tropical reef-building coral cousins by being rather solitary individuals. We found many hooked slipper snails clinging to and hitchhiking on the backs of dogwiggles. We found a small, fleshy, pale, skin-breathing, burrowing sea anemone and a flat-topped porcelain crab with the most beautiful sapphire or cerulean blue claws and a 6-inch-long moss-headed warbonnet fish. Check that out on Google, moss-headed warbonnet. And those were just the highlights. Well, now let's think about green crabs again. I'm playing this repeat interview as a preview of some upcoming programs this summer. We'll have a field trip with the green crab monitoring team here in town, and we'll have more interviews on citizen science activities in our area. So let's now listen to that interview. Last July, Jeff Adams of Washington Sea Grant and Emily Grayson of the University of Washington came up to Port Townsend to lead a program for the Port Townsend Marine Science Center. Their subject was the invasive European green crabs. Well, today on Nature Now, Jeff and Emily have joined me to talk to our radio audience about these nasty little creatures. I have to sort of say, of course, they're probably not nasty in their native environment, but they seem to be nasty when they invade places like the Salish Sea. I did a little reading, of course, about European green crabs, and I learned that they first arrived from Europe at Cape Cod in the mid-1800s. By 1997, they made it to the outer coasts of Oregon and Washington. And in 2012, not too long ago, an established population was reported in Sook Harbor, British Columbia. Jeff, can you tell us a bit about the story of the European green crab, how it made its way from the coasts of Europe to the east coast of the United States and then on to the Salish Sea?
Sure. And thanks again for having us and allowing us to share some information about these crabs. Invasive species are moved all around the world in all sorts of ways, and our best chance to reduce the impacts of green crab and others is really to address those pathways before they're ever introduced. And a lot of effort goes into preventing that sort of movement now, but in the past, we didn't give it that much thought or attention necessarily. So species like the green crab came from Europe to the east coast of the United States, likely in ship's ballast or the ballast water that were on the ships to keep them balanced as they loaded and unloaded materials and people. And sometimes people would intentionally or unintentionally move species as they would make these journeys. The first populations in California likely arrived in ballast water again, but much more recently from the East Coast. But it's actually a natural ocean current that brought them from California up into the western water of the western states. And in the late 90s, when there was a really strong El Nino, the currents were perfect for supporting these larval crabs as they're in the water column, and they brought them. And as that water moved north, it pushed them into different bays along the coast. And the populations in Oregon and Washington were not very successful ultimately in establishing abundant breeding populations. But several of the populations on Vancouver Island became very well established, extremely abundant, and continue to thrive. And as you mentioned, a thriving population was found in 2012 in Sook Inlet, just across
the straits. Yeah,
exactly, real close by, and that again, because that's the first time they'd been found in the inland waters of the Salish Sea. So we may have been hoping that the straits were something of a barrier to them coming into our waters. But again, now that they're found inside, the concerns have been raised about them being able to spread more easily into our inland waters, which may be more suitable. And we have 2,200 miles of inland marine waters in Washington alone.
So, you know, that kind of raises the next question of, well, just what happens when the European green crabs do become established in a new location? What changes do we see in the local ecology?
This is a globally successful invasive species. It's established populations in Australia, Sri Lanka, South Africa, the southeastern coast of South America, in addition to the east and west coasts of North America. So we've actually had a lot of opportunities to look at what happens to an ecological community when this new species arrives in lots of different contexts. And the primary way in which the European green crab impacts native communities is through its role as a predator. This is a crab that will eat pretty much anything it can get its claws around. It's a generalist predator, so that means it has a really wide diet. So it'll eat snails, bivalves like clams and oysters and mussels, and marine worms, as well as even species of crab that are smaller than it is. So primarily it can impact populations of native species by eating them. But I think some of the other effects that have been harder to anticipate are those that occur indirectly as the effects trickle through the complex ecological communities. So there's a really good story about what happened in Bodega Harbor, which is just north of San Francisco Bay, that I think is pretty illustrative of this. There was another non-native species of clam that had been present since the 1960s. And that species was kept in check by a native clam that was a better competitor. But in the 90s, when the green crab arrived, it turned out the green crab would rather eat the native clam than the non-native clam. And so by eating the better competitor, the native clam, the green crab created an opportunity for the non-native clam to become very abundant. Even though it didn't interact with the non-native clam, it indirectly facilitated.
Affected the food web.
Absolutely.
So it's the fact that they're generalists that make them so successful?
That's certainly one aspect of it. Wherever they go, they're happy to sample the local cuisine and find something to eat on the menu. They are also, like a lot of other successful non-native species around the world, in that they have a very wide environmental tolerance. They can survive at pretty low salinities and pretty high salinities, and that gives them access to habitats that other species can't. So they can actually take refuge from the larger Dungeness crabs and rock crabs that would be eating the smaller, relatively smaller green crabs in areas of low salinity because those large crabs won't go there.
And are the green crabs likely to be predators on juvenile Dungeness?
They can be, for sure. There's definitely been experimental work showing that if the Dungeness crabs, when they're young, are smaller and overlap in habitat, the green crabs are happy to eat those guys.
Okay, so now I'm going to ask you to paint me a picture. We're on radio, so you can't show me one. What does a European green crab look like? And how would I distinguish it from our just sort of native, like we've got a purple shore crab and we've got some hairy crabs? And what does it look like?
The first thing you think about when you hear the name green crab is the color, green. And that's a little bit misleading because they can be a wide range of colors. They can be brownish. When they're very young, they can be almost entirely white. So what we really look at when we look at telling crabs apart is the shape of their back shell. And that the crab lingo for that part of the crab is called a carapace. We have a bunch of native crabs that are very small. They're similar in size to the European green crab. But they have a very square back shell, just almost like a pure rectangle. And in contrast, the European green crab has a carapace that is almost shaped like a pentagon or a fan, one of those sort of a fan like a geisha would have and hold open. And the really best way to distinguish a green crab from the native crabs is to look at the number of spines they have on the edge of that back shell. So if you're looking at a crab from the top, and you start at one of the eyes and count outward, you'll notice that each species of crab has a different number of those spines. Those are called marginal teeth. And the number of spines can help you tell which species. Our native shore crabs, the purple shore crab and the hairy shore crab, only have 3 of those spines, but the green crab has 5, and that's entirely distinct from any of the other native species that folks are likely to see on the beach.
So count the spines.
Count the spines.
I'm one of these people, when I find an interesting intact crab shell on the beach, I'll pick it up and take it home. So I was telling Emily earlier, when I was reading about this and getting ready for the show, I had to search through my collection of crab carapaces to make sure I did not have any European green crabs, and I did not.
Thankfully.
Yeah, thankfully, right. So now that we know to count the spines, and if you get to 5, we'll be concerned about it. Jeff, what are your biggest worries about the possibility of the European green crabs becoming well established on the Washington side of the Straits of Juan de Fuca and in the Salish Sea and down into Puget Sound?
Good question, because that's really the key to being an invasive species. Is there needs to be some reason that we're concerned about it. There's plenty of native species that have come from other places that we use in our daily lives, in agriculture, in aquaculture, in landscaping that don't cause any harm. The success of the crabs on the Vancouver Island really kind of raised our concern about the habitats in Washington's inland waters, and that they'll make crabs feel right at home, allowing them to spread widely and have some of those ecological impacts and potentially some of the economic impacts to aquaculture that have been observed on the East Coast and elsewhere. We didn't really materialize as a problem when they invaded the outer coast, but there are concerns that if they're more successful in our inner waters, that that could be a real problem. So having an economic impacts along with ecological impacts is really a double whammy.
So I'm thinking about aquaculture, and the thing that immediately comes to mind are the mussel farms. Are they successful predators on mussels?
They certainly are capable of doing so. I think some of the aquaculture techniques that we use for growing mussels could potentially protect their mussels from the green crab somewhat. So growing mussels off of the bottom mm-hmm. would make it harder for green crabs to get to them. But there might also have to be some adjustments to the way mussel farming is managed to protect green crabs if they are successful in locations where mussel farming is important.
Well, and then what about small juvenile oysters?
Definitely. So oyster beds are places where lots of other non-native species are found as well. So any small shellfish is vulnerable to crabs, and in places where they are farmed, oyster growers have already compensated somewhat for crabs as predators on their oyster beds. They set their oyster beds up in places where crabs are less likely to be problematic. So in some ways, the shellfish growers have indicated that they aren't as concerned about this species being problematic for them as folks on the East Coast mm-hmm. have been. And one of the reasons is that in Washington State, shellfish beds are largely managed privately for aquaculture. So you can do things like put nets over clam beds to protect the clams. On the East Coast, they're just starting to explore some of those ideas.
Of course, as you sort of implied earlier, there's always the, you don't know what's going to happen to the rest of the food web when you introduce somebody new and different who's an active feeder. I want to kind of go to the next step, which is, what can be done to prevent the establishment of green crab populations in our waters? And what would you suggest that the radio listeners do to help?
We are learning a whole lot about the different ways in which green crab and other invasive species are being transported. And as a result of that knowledge, there have been changes in the way shellfish industry activities are regulated and shipping industry activities. So ballast water is more heavily managed, and the transport of equipment and organisms for aquaculture is also managed to help reduce the probability of spreading this species and others. In addition, we're hoping that raising awareness through activities like this and through working with volunteers to monitor for this species can help increase our probability of finding them as soon as they get here. To our knowledge, they're not yet in Washington inland waters, and our greatest chance for eradicating them if they do arrive, or reducing their impact by reducing their numbers, is to find them as soon as they get here and before they get to such great population densities that they're just intractable, I guess.
So on my forays on the beach, if I find a crab shell that has five spines between the eye going out to the side, what do I do?
We have set up a Facebook page. Our group is called Washington WSG Green Crab.
That would be WSG for Washington Sea Grant Green Crab.
Exactly. And we would love it if folks would like our Facebook page, and they can also follow our Twitter feed at WA Green Crab, at WA Green Crab. And you can post pictures of what you think might be a green crab to our pages or to our Twitter feed. You can also report the species to the Washington Invasive Species Council through their reporting mechanisms. And then we can verify the identification and get some on-the-ground eyes to see if there really is an established population or if this was just sort of a transient episode.
in addition, thanks to funding from the Puget Sound Marine and Nearshore Grant Program and support from Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife and other partners, we are establishing a monitoring program to identify any populations that have moved around by natural currents and begin to establish in Washington's inland waters. And it's a volunteer monitoring program, so we welcome anyone interested to contact us through our Facebook page or Twitter feed or our email, crabteam@uw.edu, to express interest, and we'd be happy to get you involved in the program.
Okay, so let me ask you to repeat that email address again.
crabteam@uw.edu.
Well, thanks. I've learned a lot about a species I knew nothing about, and actually feel sort of assured that things are being done to hopefully prevent it from being established.
That's our hope, too.
Yeah. Thank you, Jeff and Emily. This has been very interesting. Well, that was just the preview of some upcoming programs. Now, let's hear that mystery sound again. That was the begging call of a juvenile bald eagle. I told you I heard this call over the weekend on a whale-watching trip. Captain Pete Hankey of the Puget Sound Express nosed the boat up to a rocky cliff near Decatur Island. Looking up, we saw a pair of adult bald eagles sitting together on a thick, natural platform of Coast Douglas fir. Just below them, and in plain sight of Mom and Dad Eagle, was a huge nest and a baby bald eagle. Now for a few superlatives. Eagle nests are the largest of any bird in North America. It is used repeatedly over many years, and with new material added each year, it may become as large as 10 or 20 feet deep. I think the one we saw was pretty close to 20 feet. And as much as 8 to 10 feet across. The nests weigh between 1 and 2 tons. Usually, nests are used for under 5 years or so, as they either collapse in storms or break the branches supporting them just due to their sheer weight. And the last little superlative, the San Juan Islands host the greatest concentration of bald eagles in the continental United States. Well, now let's look forward and see what's coming up in the next few weeks. Charlie Fleischman, our intrepid partner in sound, will help me share the natural history calendar with you. So, Charlie.
On Saturday, June 11th, the Native Plant Society hosts a walk in Old Fort Townsend State Park to explore old growth and parasitic plants. The walk will travel multiple trails in the park to highlight the unusual plants growing in the old growth environment. Several parasitic and mycorrhizal-dependent vascular plant species will be seen and their parasitic life cycle explained.
Also on Saturday, June 11th, join the Admiralty Audubon Society for a bird walk in the forests of Fort Worden. In this typical Douglas fir habitat, you can expect to spot pine siskins, red crossbills, chickadees, kinglets, wrens, Swainson's thrush, Anna and Rufus hummingbirds, warblers, vireos, and olive-sided and Pacific slope flycatchers. Meet at 7:30 a.m. at the Commons parking lot.
Saturday, June 11th is a busy day. In the nighttime, skyward look reveals Jupiter standing quite near the moon. Look for a brilliant star just to the right of the moon. Through binoculars, Jupiter's moons Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto look like tiny stars quite close to the giant planet.
And on Tuesday, June the 14th, you can be part of a work party and summer stewardship event at the Jefferson Land Trust Duckabush Oxbow and Wetlands Preserve. It's near Brennan. The Duckabush is a beautiful river surrounded by over 1,000 acres of protected land. The river and surrounding area is home to diverse wildlife, but noxious invasive plant species such as bittersweet nightshade, teasel, and Scott's broom threaten to crowd out native plants. Come on out to visit this gorgeous preserve and help pull these noxious invasives. Check the Jefferson Land Trust website for details. So that's it for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you have enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community where we live. Contact Nature Now hosts if you have comments, observations, or ideas, or even if you think you might be interested in joining our team of Nature Now hosts. Email us at naturenow@kptz.org. Nature Now airs at noon on Wednesdays, with repeats here on KPTZ on Thursdays at 5 p.m. and Saturdays at 11:30 a.m. Recent podcasts are also available on the KPTZ website. Thanks for listening.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Today's closing music is The Tinker and the Crab, performed by Donovan.
Nice as you please comes the traveling man, drinking a bottle of milk in his hand, speaking to no one in particular, but happily. Down where yon gulls dance, driftwood lying, drying for the fire. Yellow beak and sleek, now the gulls are crying, flying higher. Out from the sea came a little green crab, taking the sun, the morning being very drab. Oh, rusty cans, pebbles bedded in the sand, stand and stare. The tinker and the crab, the tinker and the crab.